very much, Katie. Katie Armstrong will be next. Thank you. Sorry, Katie Radford. Sorry.
Can I do it from the...
I'll just open it.
Thank you.
En anglais, avec un accent d'Irlande du Nord. Thank you very much to those who've enabled me to come here today and supported the process. I'm very grateful to you. I'm going to do a little bit of Northern Ireland 101 for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to live through the conflict. I'm going to introduce you to a little bit about how it started and why it is where it is in the position that it is today. Excuse me. I managed to turn that off now. And then what I'm going to talk about a little bit is about the role that the organisation for whom I work, for the Institute for Conflict Research, the sort of work that we do, and give you some examples of the sort of practice that we engage in our policy-related work. I'm very humbled by the previous speakers, all of whom are dealing with conflicts which are much larger than those that we've dealt with, but ours has gone on for quite some time now. Some might say it's 40 years, some would say it's 400 years. I'll leave it to your own decisions to where you place that. But it's very humbling for me to be here with those people who have shared their narratives and their stories today, so thank you so much. Northern Ireland remains a very divided society. We're 15 years after the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed to bring peace and reconciliation, allegedly, to the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland. And I'll get on to the challenges that we face in the language and how we talk about the area of the world in which I live and work and love. Between 1966 and 1998, we had over 3,500 people were killed, over 40,000 people were injured, countless were interned as a result of state policies, and many disappeared in the process. We have had a series of ceasefires. We've had post-ceasefire activities. We've had a victims' order, which was introduced in 2006 on the back of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought to the attention of people the experiences of those who were victims and are survivors of the conflict. We've had a series of very imperfect inquiries, which have cost far more money than had ever been spent on the victims of the conflict, and a series of inquests. And there's been a number of initiatives that have been, all of which have been, I suppose, civil-led in terms of how we've started to think about dealing with the past. We had the consultative group on the past in 2009, which has come up with a series of recommendations. The one it came up with on reparations was actually the straw that broke the camel back, and everybody ran away from it all of a sudden. So we then had a series of apologies which came out, some of which were acceptable, some of which seemed to be unacceptable. We had the Combined Loyalist Military Command giving theirs in 1994, the INLA, the Irish Republican, the Irish National Movement in 1998, the IRA in 2002, and the British government in 2010 after Bloody Sunday. I put on this image, as you can see, a picture of three people. For those of you who aren't familiar with all three of them, the man in the middle used to have a balaclava and a woolly face, and he's now our First Minister. The man on the left is our Deputy First Minister and allegedly killed the cousin of the lady on the left and the right in the hat, who is the Queen, and allegedly perpetrated a number of state violations against a variety of people in the conflict. So we have three key actors here who are all reconciled, but yet we still don't have agreement on how we deal with the past. In Northern Ireland, we have a very strong third sector. Some of that is to do with a lack of support that many people felt the state provided for them. Others feel that it came out of a very committed people for working without the needs of the state. And what that's done is to provide a huge amount of self-support for communities of interest and families who feel that they are still at need of support from one another. Northern Ireland is still in a position of political unrest and instability. We've just had the Hasso-Sullivan talks. I think it's important that we remember that there was no Sullivan in there, because mostly these peace talks are run by men, and I've been very interested by the gendered notion that people have brought to the talks so far. And the gendered aspect of our conflict has been huge, and it's something that I'll refer to later on. The O'Sullivan-Haas talks had 600 submissions, it had 7 drafts, it had 100 meetings, and over 1,500 people participated in that process. But still we're no further on in terms of the three areas that the Northern Ireland Assembly, so this is the first time the government have sought to address the challenges of the past on the three key areas which were dealing with the past: flags and public order and protest. So I say all of this to sort of lay the ground for where we are. There's a huge expectancy that truth commissions will be able to support what we do. Many people advocate for a truth commission in Northern Ireland. We still do not have one. We do, however, as I mentioned earlier, have a commission for victims and survivors, and that provides us with a variety of mechanisms that we need at this time. So where are we? Well, we're still killing one another. It's a bit unfortunate. It doesn't get the headlines that it used to get. We've dropped off the numbers, so it probably doesn't reach international news. It barely reaches local news. We're still crucifying young people, and I have chosen purposefully not to bring you the sort of images which I find very distressing in the work that I do, but we do literally hurt the young people around us. So while a lot of the work that we do is rights-based, we still are in huge contravention of things like CRC, CERD, and CEDAW, which were referred to by previous speakers. One of the challenges for us in Northern Ireland are the limitations that are well rehearsed in terms of what truth commissions and processes have: the passage of time on evidence, the changing contexts, that commissions are only mandated to investigate certain crimes or periods or actors in the process. And the need for amnesty and immunities is something that we're not yet in a position to be able to think about, as well as the financial restraints that impact on the sort of questions that the truth commissions are asking. In Northern Ireland, a truth recovery process has additional problems for communities, and namely that's their readiness to engage in the process themselves. And I've enumerated here a number of those key challenges that face communities who are coming out of conflict, and in particular our own. The capacity, including disputes within families. We've had a huge amount of communities who were split because of their allegiances to either state or paramilitary-based organisations, and that's created challenges for them. And as many speakers have spoken about so far, those voices which are dominant, those which are strong political activists, and some who are not yet able to advocate for the changes that they need to make their own lives better. There's a challenge around the readiness and the re-traumatisation that comes for those in terms of shared working. And there's a huge amount of unmet needs. The Victims Commission and the new Victims Service, which we have in place, which provides welfare support as well as a variety of other support mechanisms for victims and survivors of the conflict, doesn't yet provide all of those. And there's a series of unmet needs that they're unable to do, which doesn't come under the victim's order. And one of those, most importantly, I feel, is the transgenerational impact of the conflict, what that's meaning on young people and on further generations. Clearly, the use of public space, how we commemorate in private, in public, how we are policed in those processes, are also part of the re-traumatization of adults and young people who are living through their memories of the conflict. And there's a series of disengagement from public institutions, from political institutions, including statutory service providers. Policing is a very contested issue now within our community. Traditionally, it was seen by the Protestant Unionist Loyalist, if you'll excuse the expression, as opposed to the Catholic Nationalist Republican community, as being very one-sided. Now the police have absolutely no support whatsoever from working-class young people and working-class adults in the communities in which they're living. All feel betrayed by their policing service and refer to it as a force. Sectoral short-termism, limited strategic planning, all of these things are impacting on whether or not communities are able to engage, and the political instability around such issues, such as the flag recently being taken down in Belfast city centre. The Union flag used to fly there 365 days of the year. It was taken down, can only fly on designated days now, and this has created huge instability for communities in Belfast now. We've had up to 20,000 people out on the streets rioting last year, and this has left a legacy in communities, a huge criminalisation of young men who took part in this process. And the legacy, again, they refer to it as the mini-troubles, and some of them refer to wanting to pass their time to become ex-prisoners as part of this process. There's a legitimacy and a machismo attached to this process. And there's a lack of consensus about the language that we use. And I'd like to drill into that just a little bit, because although the experiences won't be the same for you, I think it's important that we drill down into these areas. For example, we're not quite sure who are victims and whether or not we have perpetrators or whether all our perpetrators are victims. So you find now in victims' groupings, the majority of people attending them now are very often coming from as former combatants, whether there's a state or non-state combatants. So there's a challenge for those who feel whether they're state or non-state combatants should not be in the room with those who see themselves as what they describe as innocent victims of the conflict. So there's a hierarchy being created within who is considered to be suffering as a result of the conflict over this. We don't know whether to refer to combatants as paramilitaries, as state actors, as arms groups, and whether or not the actions taken by the state should be considered those which are should create victims in and of themselves or not. So there's a huge dichotomy arising for people about the status. We're also not clear about whether people who have disappeared or whether they've been disenfranchised or exiled or killed by their own or otherwise vanished, whether we should consider these people to be victims or not. So there's no clarity on this issue. If somebody had blown themselves up as part of a bombing campaign, are these considered victims? Are they not? So we play with this constantly, and it creates further division within communities. And we're concerned, too, about whether we incorporate those people who have been traumatized as a result or suffered in some way, as a result of witnessing or incorporating other people's violence in their own psyche over long periods, whether they've been working with them in a variety of healing capacities or otherwise. So we've drawn on the international learning. We've had Cyril Ramaphosa came in and oversaw some of our decommissioning for us, which was very helpful. We've had lots of people telling us that we need to adopt other people's processes, which isn't quite as helpful. And there's a lot of challenges, I suppose, you'll find when you're moving from a difference between moving away from a monarchy or in a dictatorship to the experiences that we've had in the north of Ireland. But what's really clear for us, I suppose, is that we're apology plus, and as I say, acknowledgement light. We none of us yet acknowledge our roles within for what we've done. In terms of civil society, in terms of advocacy and service delivery, and in terms of dealing with the past, there are three key areas in which people are working. Health and social care, which is a gateway to these two other key areas, both acknowledgement and truth recovery processes and methodologies. And that's what the role of civil society seems to focus on. We don't look on reparations, although there are some people who are advocating for that process. The organisation for whom I work for is a small NGO. We're a not-for-profit research-based organisation. We develop policy and practice based around primary research that we do. So, for example, we've recently been working with 1,500 young people that we've been working with over a number of months. We've done 50 focus groups with them, 10-page questionnaires, and what's really coming out of that kind of work informs the sort of practice that we'll then work with young people and encourage the statutory service providers to take on board. We do a series of community development trainings, workshops, site visits, and sort of add to the whole smoke and mirrors of what's going on in and around Northern Ireland, particularly working on issues such as culture, citizenship, commemoration, democracy, segregation, identity, prisoners, and restorative justice to some degree. And one of the ways that we do that is that we try and create safe spaces for people to come to the table and to talk about particular programs. And we did a report a little while ago called Hearing the Voices. We felt that prior to the setting up of the Victims Commission, that there weren't enough opportunities for victims and survivors to come together to consider what their experiences were, to consider what they wanted to advocate for in terms of change, and also for those who were ready to talk with those who had perpetrated the atrocities which brought them to the state they were in to face them. We provide a series of opportunities for internal discussions within paramilitary organisations and within statutory services who have found that they're unable to provide the sort of services that are required. And we use a variety of different frameworks, including storytelling and oral history work, to do so, including the visual and oral arts. In terms of the truth recovery mechanisms that we use, storytelling is a very important one. We like to provide people with the opportunity to do so. But we're mindful of the fact that they do bring re-traumatization for some people unless they're handled very carefully. So we work very closely with a variety of different agencies who are able to provide the support that people need, both in the long, medium, and short term. There is a challenge we find sometimes in terms of how narrative is then used. We're mindful of the fact that it can be used for political ends and that there's a need and desire within some communities to bolster up something which has been a very fragile truth or mixed truths within there, and that they use storytelling to try and become evidence, which isn't necessarily helpful in the healing of that community as they go through it. So we've devised a program which we call Music of Memories. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the programs we're working with people so that you can see the complexities of the narratives that come out within them. Music of Memories was a program that we ran in seven different locations with people who decided they wanted to buy into this process. And rather than being ready, that none of them were ready to share exactly what their experiences were with the other, but they wanted to work with the other. So over an eight-week period, we built up their confidence to start to reveal the stories and the parts of the story they wanted to work with. And they took their pieces of music, which were diachronically leading them through what their experiences had been. Some people talked about loss, the loss of time they'd had when they were in prison. Some people talked about loss in terms of people that they'd lost that were close to them. Some people talked about a loss of a limb. And it was really all about how, what particular music triggered these things for them, whether it was something that a particular artist that they'd come together with. And bit by bit, or a piece of music they'd learned, bit by bit, they started to weave their musics together. And over an eight-week period, in addition to the previous, to the preliminary work we'd done with them, they then started to tell their stories. And these groups have now stayed together over a sort of year or two-year period, which I think is quite a long time to make a commitment to people who you were very diametrically opposed to in the first place. We've also done a series of programs where we're working in terms of commemoration and memorialization, because we found that in the public space, there's challenges for people in how they use how they commemorate, because people are taking offense at somebody else's loss. People have been putting murals, people have been putting up plinths, and somebody's history is no longer a shared history in Northern Ireland. They find that it's too divisive. So we try and find different ways that educators can come together and evidence how they can show good practice in terms of the use of material culture. So we've devised a series of things where archives, artifacts, and memorial gardens are all brought to people's attention, and they have to feed into them in a way that shows respect for other people's loss. Acknowledgement and reflection are key areas where we find that people are ready to come together, but they're not quite sure how to do so. They're not quite sure what's in their collective imagination in terms of acknowledging what do we need to tell one another about. So we've got a couple of programs that we run with them. One is called the FIRST program, From Intolerance to Respect, Sharing and Trust. And we work with people over, again, an eight-week period and a 96-hour contact time. And we work with them through a series of hate crime incidents. So they look at their own communities where hate crimes have been perpetrated. They look at their losses. They come together to share their stories and their narratives about what happened within their communities. And then we take them over a five-day period to Auschwitz-Birkenau, where they start to look at themselves in terms of their roles as collaborators, as perpetrators, as witnesses, and as victims and survivors of the conflict in reflection with what had happened during the Shoah, during Holocaust. And we find that the people who have gone on those programs tend to come back and they want to find ways to stay connected to those people with whom they've been engaged in the past. We've also been involved in developing a day of reflection, which gives people an opportunity to, as it says on the tin, just reflect on what happened. Some people aren't ready to do that, and they don't want to do so publicly, but it gives people and organizations a space in which to do so privately, but also to recognize that it's happening within a context of something that's going on throughout the north of Ireland. One of the challenges, I suppose, for us is that people seem to feel that an apology is always necessary. An apology isn't always able to be given or received because very often they're not carefully crafted enough. They don't acknowledge hurt, they don't express regret, they don't acknowledge that there has to be non-repetition in terms of how they're going to go forward. So we don't seek apologies from people in the work that we do with them, but we recognize that some people are still seeking those, that it's not a prerequisite to that work. So I guess I'll sort of end this by just suggesting that what we're doing is to recognize that we've tried to make sense of the past apart, and now we recognize that really it's time for us to try and make sense of the future together. This work is all used to develop policy, and we work very closely with government to try and change their attitudes to segregated housing, because still 97% of our communities live in segregated housing. 90% of our young people are still educated separately, and there is an increase in the physical violence that's being perpetrated by and against against women in our communities, by those who are still former combatants, whether that's state or non-state. So thank you.